Okay, so Benjamin, first things first, how are you?
I'm good, thank you. How are you?
I'm not too bad at all. Before we delve into the new album, I'd like to jump back because the last time we spoke, we talked a little bit about kind of the transformation that you've went through and getting sober and then kind of changing your life for the better. If now with some separation, how do you look back at those, especially first two albums, that what are the feelings when you think of those albums?
It's a good question. I think it took me so long to be able to like listen to those albums, and they're not things I put on and listen to regularly, but once in a I was so afraid of kind of I don't know why, but I was so afraid of listening to them. I think I just put such a high bar on myself personally and musically that I found it really difficult for like I'd say 8 or 9 years until pretty recently to even accept that people liked them, or that I'd been somewhat successful, or that I'd connected with people. I don't know what I think it was just a lot of kind of fear and self-centeredness, to be honest. But now I look back and I think, especially with the first album, the kind of my first kind of sharing myself with the world, I look back with a lot of gratitude, gratitude for the label I was lucky enough to sign with in Dirty Hit, and gratitude. People don't really people think that I did have this, but I never really had like an, at least before the album, I never really had like an industry buzz, like a whining and dining. And the game's kind of changed a bit, as we know, with the internet. And
Sure.
I'm really grateful that I kind of just made that album by, at least wrote it, by myself in my room, with a hole in my heart. It's like a young emo kid, imperfect in many ways, and through various moments of grace, was lucky to make it in a cheap way, and put it out with a label where we could celebrate the little wins, And I think I'm really aware that that album is like the album of mine that people, continue to listen to and want to hear and speak about in a high regard, which I'm really grateful for, I think as a songwriter, I'm always trying to get back to that point of before one's soul is like prostituted by the industry, before you like know about streaming and radio and deals and advances and publish all this stuff. And the second album, as we discussed a few years ago, it took like there was a 6 year break between my first album and my second album, and it was just because I'd made this album kind of by mistake. It's like I'll give this a go, and got really lucky with some timing, and then was span around the world for 3 years and played shows and met all these people and had this wild adventure. And then I was like, I kind of had to. I felt like honestly, I was still not awake when I was making that second album, and I'm grateful that there are some songs on it, Tillicum in particular, Some Other Arms in particular, that I really love. And even the songs that I don't necessarily, that I feel a certain way about, I'm still aware that for some people they're their favorite songs, So and I'm really grateful to the producer of the second album, Charlie Andrews, who caught me when I was in such I was so lost and in such a mess and so wrapped up in self, that he was so gracious with the time he gave me and the love that he gave me. And he's a good friend of mine to this day, Charlie Andrews. So I feel really, as a songwriter, I feel like the songs kind of land on me, I mean, I know that sounds cheesy, but like they land, and then one has to learn like the craft part of it, where you sit down and you go, right, how do I finish this? Where's the capo on the guitar? What's a BPM? What does it need? So I look back on it with just like, oh my God, thank you so much. I'm lucky to be alive, and that first album changed my life. I mean, it's crazy.
You mentioned that kind of f sense of freedom as you're working on kind of what eventually will become a debut album because there's no expectations yet, and there's just you're just making it for the sake of it, I suppose. How do you then try to recapture that something like that in the writing process for a new album now? Do you try to kind of go back to that headspace of not worrying too much about what other people might think, or that there's kind of a livelihood attached to it?
Yeah, it's so hard to get back there, and I'm always trying to get back to being that kid in his room, you know, listening to Blink-182 and David Gray and, you know, Placebo and all the bands that I loved. And I mean, it is possible. I think the way to do it, and everyone's got a different path to this. For some people, it's, you know, faith or therapy or the yoga, whatever it is, you know, but it's basically just like finding a way where I can reduce my fear and reduce my self-awareness is a word that's coming to mind, but I know that sounds kind of complicated and weird, but basically reducing my fear and just going, what's on my heart? Like, what's coming more from here and less from here, you know, and kind of trying to get out of the way of myself and just sit down and go, okay, what am I really feeling? What do I want to say? What's the truth? Instead of overanalyzing every word and every line for the sake of second guessing what someone else might think, you know. And I've written a lot of bad songs, man. Honestly, I continue to write a lot of bad songs. I've probably even released some bad songs, but you know, for me, it's just a process of like fear reduction, but it is really hard. I mean, we only have to look at all of our favorite bands to know like how many times is like the debut album like the most amazing album.
Sure.
But it is possible, you know, to get back to that place. But for me, it takes a lot of work, and I actually think this new album is the best I've made. But there's always going to be an innocent naivety about a debut album. You know, I'm 34 now. I was 21 when I put out the album, and it would be like facetious and fake of me to try and imitate that person as well. So
Sure.
I'm just like, I'm grateful for that album. I can't believe I'm still here and I get to do this and write all these songs and stuff. And yeah, it's a weird thing.
But it is interesting because, as you mentioned, I mean, we are getting older. The last time I spoke to you was in 2019, and it doesn't feel like 5 years ago. So that's a crazy thing. But then, as you
Yeah.
mentioned as well, in terms of the songwriting, then on this new album, you do seem to appear very, very candid, very open, and honest about the thoughts that you had, and also writing conceptually from the perspective of others. But what do you think? Is it just getting older that allowed you to be more free in this, in terms of songwriting, or more open?
Maybe it's getting older. Yeah, I think again, it's like just you know, the path I've been trying to walk since getting well is like it's a lot of ego death and fear reduction, you know. So I think I'm just hiding less. I wouldn't. It's almost like I this will sound weird, but it's like I wouldn't say I care less because I'm more in love with music than I've ever been. But I'm more just like, do I love this, you know? And of course there are times when I have to trust my manager and co-writers and stuff, you know. My belief is that the artist is, at least in a creative sense, not in a life sense, but definitely not in a life sense, but in a creative sense, good artists are right 90% of the time. But I spent a lot of my life thinking I was right 100% of the time, and the result of that was a veil of tears, you know. So it's like that crack in the window, that 10%, am I willing to let the opinions of others in to guide me and, you know, and to counsel me. So yeah, that's kind of my thoughts on that. And I'm just hiding less, you know. I'm less, you know. I said this to a friend the other day, you know, like I'm the when I'm off beam and in my own nonsense, I'm the kind of guy that will go out in London and talk about how much I love Fat White Family and then go home and cry to Fix You in the shower, you know. That's like that sums up my life. And I love Fat White Family and I love Coldplay, you know what I mean? It's not about
Sure.
the bands, but it's just about that, like, I think I was when I live my life like I'm just desperate to be liked, it goes bad, you know. So like fear is out of the way, and I think working on this album, it was just like, okay, do I love this? And there were moments where I had to be a little persuaded and counseled, you know, but overall, it's just less fear is the only way I can really put it.
Yeah, that's excellent to hear. And I think there's a line in, I think it was Spokane, Washington. I think I'm getting better at getting over me, and that's something I always have in my mind. You mentioned kind of the ego and ego death, kind of getting over yourself. I think that's such an important thing, and for me, it only happens once you're. I'm 37 now, so in my 20s, it was really idealistic, and everything is so, I don't know, important to you. And then you get a little bit older, and it becomes easier letting certain things go. So for you, how has songwriting kind of contributed to this development in yourself, where you can kind of let things go or be a little bit more objective about things?
I'm just so in love with songs, you know, and I'm just obsessed with them. I have been since I was like, as soon as I could hear, basically. You know, I remember being very, I didn't know what was going on, but I felt moved by them. And one thing that's happened, I was doing it a bit when we last spoke, but more and more is most of my time I go to the studio and write with other artists for their projects, you know, and I'm sure we'll get into that. And I got lucky with a few things, and now we're busy doing that, you know, and that awareness that, like, you know, a new artist or someone who's like 11 years younger than me can come in and like write something and sing something so beautifully that's better than anything I could have thought up. It is good for my in answer to your question about that, like, how has songwriting helped with the ego deflation? It's like hearing someone come in and be like open-hearted and willing enough to be like, oh my God, that's amazing. You know, so much of the time my job in that songwriting capacity is to like say nothing. You know, like I work a lot, to give you a recent example, I work a lot, you may have spoken to her, but I work a lot with an artist called Katie Gregson McLeod, who put out a song called Complex a few years ago that like blew up the internet. It's one of the most amazing ballads. And when we're writing together, you know, she literally just kind of goes dark and goes into a notebook and goes quiet, and we go quiet in the room, and then she'll just say some amazing lyrics, you know, and 99% of the time they're unreal, you know. So I think allowing a patient appreciation of like others' gifts, you know, has helped that with songwriting. Man, we're going pretty deep. I feel like we're breaking the fourth. I feel like we're in Inception here. This is good though. I love these kind of chats. You know, it's like there are no rules to it either. And just being more honest, you know, about what I actually love, you know, and like having an open heart. And I listen to a lot of pop music. I'm sure I've said this before, but my two favorite ever songs are Hero by Enrique Iglesias and Believe by Cher. You know, and
Okay.
like people in my game, like, or in my corner of the industry might think, oh, they're lame songs, but actually, like, they're spiritually intersectional. You know what I mean? They grab the heart of the common person, for want of a better word. And like, that is, I was a taker for so long in life, and like a self-centered hurricane that now I just want to give and give and give. And I think the number one emotion that people like meditate on, at least that I do, is like love, gaining love or loss of love. And actually, like, I'd be quite happy writing love songs and ballads forever. You know, like I love the other stuff, but, you know, I love like, you know, like Doja Cat, artists like this, my friends Gang of Youths, who I love the Kacey
Sure.
Musgraves album. I love Mark Cohen, you know, but I'm My I was listening to, do you know the song "My Heart Will Go On" by Celine Dion?
Of course, yeah.
I literally listened to that on repeat for an hour the other night. I just had Alexa play "My Heart Will Go On," play this song on repeat, and it was just going round and round. And I was happy, you know. I love that song.
Oh, that's amazing. And I mean, I have a similar thing with you mentioned Fix You by Coldplay, and I have a piano there. I started to learn Fix You by Coldplay, and it's one of those songs. It's a little bit cheesy, but at the same time, it's such an impactful song, and it's just so beautiful that I, like you said, I can put it on for an hour, you know, on repeat, and it does something to you.
Mate, it's an amazing song, and I mean the outro is just outrageous when it kicks off, and
Right.
da-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na, you know, and the harmonies, and yeah, I mean it. But the thing is, you know, you can. I remember watching a clip on YouTube of like a kid who had neurodivergencies crying into his dad's arms at a Coldplay show listening to that song. I mean, that's what's at stake here. You know what I mean? With like songwriting and like being able to lift people's hearts. Like, you know, me and you are in the game and we know like all cool bands and da 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 da. But actually, like most people, like my sister and her girlfriend or her wife to be now, actually, they'll be like at the party, they'll be like, put on Westlife. You know what I mean? And like, that's cool. I mean,
Sure.
I know the guy who wrote Flying Without Wings, a guy called Wayne Hector, and he's an absolute legend. And I've written with him many times, and he's as real as like, I don't want to reference bands, but like as the coolest buzz bands of today. You know,
Sure.
it's like, for me, feel like a lot of people need music to breathe. You know, it's, you just go on the YouTube on the comment section. It's like, I was depressed, or I was sad, or I was lonely,
Right.
and this saved my life, and this song saved my life, and I listened to this song, it helped me for a dark. That's like what's at stake here. So when you know, I have an artist coming over today in an hour and a half, and like, you know, God willing, we can write something that's useful. That's I've been taught in my path, like, to fit myself to be of maximum usefulness to others, you know, to God and to my fellow man. And I by myself, I can't do that. But when I'm tapping into a higher energy that I get through talking to others and creating with others, I can do that. But by myself, I'm sat by myself trying to make a second album for 6 years, caught in fear with every opportunity and privilege in the world, and just overthinking it to the point of insanity.
So you need that little push once in a while.
100% I do, yeah.
What was then the, because some things break. I mean, obviously the world has been in a crazy place for the past couple of years, at least yeah, globally speaking. I mean, every country has its own problems, I suppose as well. But how do you know then that you're ready for a new album? Or how did you just have a couple of songs that were moving in a certain direction that you knew, okay, now I have something to say and I can start working on this?
Yeah, it's for me this time it was definitely the latter. You know, I'm always, every time I finish an album, I'm always like, oh my God, you know, what am I gonna do next? Like, even for the next album after Some Things Break, all I've got at the moment is two verses, you know, for a song called Gabriella, but I love the verses so much. And for this time, for Some Things Break, you know, I met a guy called Jimmy Hogarth at a Spotify writing camp at the end of 2019. Jimmy is a legendary record producer. He's done everything from Amy Winehouse
Sure.
to Sia to Corin Bailey Ray to he co-wrote Jenny Dopey Hasty and Warwick Avenue, and he's just done the new Oenone record, which is phenomenal. And anyway, we became friends and we started writing with loads of different artists and doing songs with them for their projects. And then there was a guy called John Green who worked at Jimmy's studio, who was a lovely man. And at the time, I'd started to kind of get a bit more traction in the co-writing game via an amazing artist called Holly Humberstone, who's a great friend of mine and just a wonderful, just an unreal songwriter. And we'd had a few songs, and so I meet John, and he's like really in that game, and he's like, we're talking about that, and I'm kind of like, see, I know who he is, you know, he's a legend, so I'm like seeking his counsel a bit. I'm like, let's write some songs together. And I was really into country music at the time, and it's kind of a funny story, but it's in a way, John and Jimmy kind of, I've said this to them, so I don't think they mind me saying, but they played my hand a bit. So I was like, let's get together and write some songs for like Tim McGraw, and we'll write songs to Tim McGraw, we'll send them to the manager, and happy days. You know what I mean? In my sick mind, I was celebrating the Grammy, you know. That's how delusional I can be. And so we write these two. I've just gone through a breakup. But like I was with someone during the pandemic, and we were living together, and she was an awesome person. And it's just, you know, we grew apart, and I went into the studio feeling away, and I wrote we with John and Jimmy. We wrote two songs, one called "I'm Always Saying Sorry," which the album opens with, and one called "Some Things Break," which is like in the middle of the album. It's just a classic kind of acceptance of a love loss piano ballad,
Sure.
and Jimmy's such a seasoned sonic wizard, as well as a great songwriter, that John's playing the piano. It sounds amazing. I'm in a separate room singing. And there's like separate, there's like a sliding door in Jimmy's studio, so there's separation. And I'm like, okay, cool. Kind of forget about the songs. And then a week or two later, Jimmy sends me the bounces of I'm Always Saying Sorry and Something's Break. And I'm like, oh my gosh, this sounds so good. Like, I love this so much. And immediately I was like, not immediately, but soon after, I was like, Jimmy's got to produce the album. You know, I was on the phone to Mark, my manager, just like, man, I love these, you know. I want these for myself. Of course, I think I still pushed for us to send them to whoever, you know. And I just really loved them. And then I was like, we opened the conversation with Jimmy, and he was just so gracious and patient. And he's such an artist, you know, he's such a humble guy, and he's done amazing things. And then we started just cooking and writing more songs. And so at that point, once I had a few things, I was like, I love this. That kind of opened the floodgates to like be calling other sisters and brothers, like, right, come to the studio, let's try this, let's try this. And we wrote like 30 songs. I think we scrapped about 20 songs or something. And we were very, again, thanks to less fear, I was more assiduous with the choices, you know, and still being creative and kind of spray gunning ideas out. And around this time, I met a guy called Jamie Squire, who I'd met before years ago. He's the MD and piano player in 1975. Me and him and Jimmy worked on two songs on their last album together. And I immediately was just like feeling this vibe from Jamie, like, this guy's, you know, like one of those guys who can play everything. He's just like a
Sure.
joke. You know what I mean? He's like so good, but he's not like posh with it. You know, he's a songwriter at heart. And my perception of him is that all the instruments and stuff, which he may well be the best in the world at, are just tools for songwriting. You know, that's just a tool for songwriting. So he came to the studio. We wrote a song called Moon Landing Hoax with our friend Sam Klempner. And that again happened by accident. Me, Sam Klempner, and Jamie Squire had 2 days together. On the first day, we wrote a song, like a Pussycat Dolls kind of song, you know, trying to like a pop thing, you know, for pitch. And the second day I came in, and I was just one of those days where I was just feeling really broken and fed up of a few things. And Jamie started playing these chords, and we wrote that song in like 2 hours. Sam bounced it. I was like, I love this, you know. Can we send the stems to Jimmy so he can have a play on it? We did. Jamie came in the studio with Jimmy, we tried to get Jamie to play the piano part again, and it was never the same. It wasn't even close. So we have to use a piano from Sam's day. Jimmy was like, we can get a better vocal. I was like, I don't know, but we managed to get one just. And so that kind of process started happening. And then we'd jam more and more. John would come in, Jamie Squire would come in. Around this time, I met a really good friend. My manager's friend is a guy called Matty Smith. And he's like one of these guys who's just like such an artist. He's such a talent. Never had a song out, never had a publishing deal, never had a record deal, lives on a houseboat with his girlfriend, is a vegan. You know, I'm like painting the picture, like the nicest,
Sure.
basically, it's like an angel. And I go over to his, I'm like, yeah, I've always loved writing with people who, like I said, haven't been spun out by the game. And I like, and he was the first person in a long time that was really honest with me, potentially brutal with me. I'd send him ideas, and he'd be like, this isn't good enough. Do you know what I mean? Like, so there was a trust there immediately. And
Right.
he gave me the title Breaking the Weather, which I then wrote with Jimmy and John. And he also co-wrote the second verse of Don't Give Up on Light, which finishes the album. So my heart was really open to all these ideas. But in answer to your first question, once I heard Something's Breaking, I'm Always Saying Sorry from Jimmy, I was like, okay, we're on, you know?
Yeah, and I think the way you talk about it was very communal. It was very, as you mentioned, an open process where you could let your guard down and have everybody kind of have their say in it or put their two cents into it. It sounds really liberating the way you talk about it. One thing that struck me immediately, because you mentioned Jimmy, is the way your voice sounds on the album. It's I don't know how to describe it really, but it's kind of less hidden away, if that makes sense. It feels like it's really right in front of you. Was there any emphasis on how your vocals sounded?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a few things. Firstly, Jimmy is such a seasoned producer. He like I've worked with great producers, but he's like a classic record producer. There's a real spring reverb in his studio. He knows like the science of microphones. He has like a sonic equilibrium between his studio setup, his home setup, and his second studio. So he really gets these things. And when I got well, I really thought that God would give me like a higher register in my voice, but weirdly, I got a one. And I think because I fell in love with country music, I started singing like, hey, I started singing a bit from down there and I could still go up there. You know what I mean? So I just embraced singing from there. At first, it was kind of like as a joke almost. But then I was like, I actually really love this. And Jimmy knew how to catch that really well. And there's some songs on the album where I'm singing in my like a more recognizable voice, shall we say? And there's some songs where I'm doing, I mean, the easiest way I can describe it, it's kind of like a crooner thing. And Jimmy knew how to catch that. And our first reference, kind of sonic reference for the album, was an album called Midair by Paul Buchanan, who's a singer of the Blue Nile, a legendary band from Scotland. And they have a song on the movie About Time. And I just love that album because there's no drums on it and it's just piano and vocal, really reserved. And that was our first reference. The album was originally going to be called Under the Stars at the SU Bar, but it was too narrow in the end. But I still like that title for another day. And wanted the vote. I love a headphone record, I love someone in the airport listening to music on their headphones and the vocals just right there and loud. I love a loud vocal. It's kind of vocals are hidden. There's one, I think 75, obviously I'm biased, but I think they've done it well on a few songs with John Gilmour, such a wizard. But I like personally, I like a vocal that's up and I mean, I speak about it. I was with Pale Waves the other day, and me and Heather were speaking about it a lot. And she loves like, a loud. She's just like, I need it loud and slap. And I'm like, yeah, me too. Like I want it. I just want the song to like explode into my head. I just kind of followed my instinct with that, and was lucky enough to be working with such a legend like Jimmy that he knew how to catch it,
Yeah, I think that's amazing because I remember I think it was Tom O'Dell who I was speaking to, and he had this emphasis on recording his vocals, and he bought this ridiculously expensive microphone and everything. But to put it up front is it allows the song to convey the emotion a lot more, I think, when the voice is very clear and crisp, and there's not it's not too muddied behind all the instruments and overproduction, if that makes sense.
I think so, man. I love songs. I'm not really a producer. I rarely take production credits on stuff. Sometimes I will, but I'm a songwriter first and foremost, above anything, Well, second to family and stuff like that. But I just love it to be up front, and I love Tom. We've worked together and he's such a legend and his bar is so high. He's all feel, and like And I've learned a great deal from working with him, actually.
Let's talk a little kind of to round off the interview. Let's talk a little bit about songwriting then. And I think there's a mix of kind of approaches to songwriting on this album. On the one hand, you mentioned Some Things Break, which is very personal. I believe it was even written not too long after that breakup that you just mentioned. But then
Yeah,
there's also
it's written
songs.
the
Oh, okay, wow.
Yeah, it was written the next day.
And then on the other hand, you also have a couple of songs where you kind of crawl into the skin of somebody else and you try to look at the world a little bit differently. So how did you balance those two approaches to songwriting? The more narrative style and the more personal confessional style in a way.
Man, honestly, as cheesy as this sounds, I just followed my heart. Like when I was feeling that way in the week after that thing we were just talking about, we wrote Some Things Break. I was just like, okay, how do I feel here? What's the most honest? John starts playing some chords and I just start going and singing and singing and we craft the song out. And it's something the first time I did it was on a song on I think it was on the last album called Cherry in Tacoma, where I was like, my whole life I'd been like, oh, I've got to write my own pain, might bleed out, all this kind of nonsense, And I was like, oh, I could just make up a story. And literally just sing and like write a story in my mind and then sing that. And with I'm Always Saying Sorry, which was recorded the same, which I think is the most intense song on the album. It was a story someone had told me about a lad at uni who was going through his life like a human hurricane and hurting others and very lost and all this stuff. And I was like, I'm gonna write, and I related to some of it, not all of it. And I was like, right, let's just try writing, getting into his skin for a while and writing a song from his perspective and just seeing what that would feel like. And kind of scarily, I felt quite at home there, you know. So it just opens up a different thing. You know, we do it with artists a lot in the studio where it's like, they're like, oh, I don't really have anything to say. I'm like, well, let's just write something from your friend's perspective or make up a story, you know, and just open that the river of options lyrically.
Sure, and I think I'm a big reader of gonzo journalism, which is kind of the sometimes fictional stories can be more true than what actually happened, I think, or can explain the truth better than what actually happened, I suppose.
Totally.
With this album now coming out, then, and then you've been in the game for quite a bit now, so how is your perspective changed in terms of what you still want to accomplish within the music industry, which is, as you mentioned, quite a volatile business. And what is it that you enjoy most or try to get out of what you do now?
Yeah, it's definitely crazy out there. It's like the Wild West at the moment. I was literally on a phone with my friend Jack Leonard from Uncle last night for an hour and a half, just like joking and just like, this is crazy. It's like the Wild West out here, you know. And just want to be useful, you know. I've never had the thing of like, probably to my own detriment. I've had the reverse. I've actually had like a horrible hipster thing in me for, or at least did early on in my career. I've never had the like, I wanna win the Grammy or I wanna play this or that. I would love to, but it's not like my fuel, you know. I just want to make beautiful stuff, and I've fallen in a lot into this co-writing game with other artists or ghostwriting, as some people call it. And I suck at writing a song for someone. I'm good at writing a song with someone occasionally when they're like there and open. So I think I just want to carry on and make beautiful music. And there may come a point where I go into the Dirty Hit office and I go, there's nothing left for me to say. I've said all I can say. And me and Jamie Oborne and Mark and Ed and everyone there shake hands and go, pleasure doing business, you know? And then you go.
Sorry to interrupt, but sorry to interrupt, but very quickly then, because I can't. You will always write songs, right? It's not like perhaps you won't release them or publish them in any way, but I assume you will always write songs.
I think so. And I love writing songs, but whether I'll always, there may come a point where like, I don't know if it'll happen or not, but I feel like I've said everything I need to say. You know, I've written about every situation and I'm happy and I've got family and kids and it's all, I think the grace in it, I hope the grace in it is knowing when to go, that's quite enough, you know, the world, but I will always write songs for sure. I hope, you know, I hope to die in the studio. I don't mean in pain or in suffering or in emaciated, but I mean like I hope to still be writing songs with like the young ones when I'm on my deathbed and we're like bouncing on lyrics, you know. I'll always write songs for sure, but whether I'll always feel like I need to be the one singing this, I think is a different matter. I'm not close to there now, but all I've got at the moment is two verses for a next album, so I don't know. Danny from The Script, who I work with a bit, once said to me, "Our songs are none of our business." And I knew exactly what he meant, you know. They're none of our business. We're just waiting. And you know, for me, I've got to try and I do this imperfectly. Sleep well, eat well, pray well, you know, hang out with family and be ready for when they land, you know.
So you're as musicians, you are conduits in a way for whatever floats from the top, and that energy you try to spread to the audience.
I really believe that, yeah.
All right. Benjamin May, I thank you so much for taking the time to talk with me. It's always a
Hey,
pleasure.
always a pleasure. I'll see you soon, okay?